Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. For episode 31, I'm joined by jeweller Lucy Gledhill. Lucy did a BA in jewellery making at Middlesex University, going on to graduate with a Master's in Jewellery and Metalwork from the Royal College of Art. Working with precious metals and wire, Lucy focuses on weaving and making chains, a process similar to working with textiles. She favours a low-tech approach to her craft, and in her words, applying myself to the miniature world where making is done whilst holding my breath in complete silence. Her work is beautiful. There's a constant sense of duality, weighty but delicate, refined yet intense. One of my favourite pieces is Swap, a hollow gold necklace with a large link at the centre of the chain, decreasing in size back to the clasp. Each link has two exposures, holes either side of the surface, revealing it not to be solid. The process required Lucy to draw silver into a gold tube prior to each link being constructed. She then filed each one to create perfectly symmetrical holes in the surface before dipping the chain into nitric acid, dissolving the silver. The result, the hollowing out of a chain. She then passed the remaining silver nitrate crystals from the process to photographer Kasia Wozniak, who used them in a wet plate collodion to photograph the same chain. The necklace and the photo are gorgeous. She has also made a number of sculptural works, such as Chain of Thought, a chain that decreases in size with each link, till it is so small it disappears. And Rope is Patient. It is a continuous silver rope chain with no beginning or end. You can see a photo of Rope is Patient on Lucy's website, a thick silver rope draped over the shoulder of a model. It extends to the floor and beyond her feet. It's magical. This rope contradicts the usual functions of a hardy practical tool, as it becomes useless by the material in which it's made. Lucy is currently working with Romley Samara Smith. Together they form Savage and Chong. Lucy interprets Romley's verbalised designs into pieces of jewellery. Her work is also stocked in the UK and the US in The New Craftsman, Studio Fusion, Flow Gallery, Diana Porter, Margaret Howe, De Vera, Curate Gifts, and the New Stone Age. She has also exhibited a number of shows such as Goldsmiths Fair, Collect, and Self Aware. She also co-founded Made by All with Karen Hartley, a technical teaching studio facilitating workshops ranging from sandcasting to designing your own wedding rings. So Lucy, it's rather dangerous having you here. I feel I'm going to want to commission a heap of your gorgeous jewellery and work by the end of the recording. But welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you for having me.
So most people understand what a jeweller does, but can you explain your particular type of jewellery making?
What's different about the way that I make jewellery is my approach is very traditional and low-tech. Mm. So it's really involved, the process of making. Like, for example, I'll make my own alloys in gold, which means melting metals together and pouring ingots and then working the ingots into wire or sheet, depending on how I'm going to use it. An ingot is like a little lump of metal, Okay. Basically. It's like once you've poured the metal, you need to pour it into a shape so that you can then work it into a usable form. Mm-hmm. It means that, like, because of this way of working, it means that I really understand the materials. Like, having an idea of the entire process means that you can control it. So, for example, gold has so many different alloys, and depending on how you want to use it, you might want to mix it in a different way. So we have the different colours of gold, like white, yellow and red, but they also have very different characteristics, which means that you can choose the right behaviour for what you need, basically.
And what about the process about how you approach an idea to making something?
Like, the ideas I'll be thinking about for years, and there'll be like running themes within my work. So like chain and what chain is. So if chain is adding strength and flexibility to a material, I like to contradict that sometimes and undermine it or question it. So I have these ideas, and also I like to work with ideas about mythology or slightly impossible objects. So if that's like the themes, they're kind of things that I'm thinking about continuously over years. But the making and the technique are things that are sort of developing slowly as well. So like, I might have an idea for a project, but I need the time to develop the techniques, as often they'll be like new to me, mm-hmm. and also like the material investment as well requires time mm. and planning
because of the financial implication of mm. buying precious metals. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So can you tell me about your career journey from where it began up until now? Because you studied jewellery making quite early on. You kind of, I guess, knew that you wanted to make jewellery?
I knew I was a maker. Uh-huh. I was probably sort of quite ambitious and wanted to do like sculpture or fine art. But whilst doing my foundation at Middlesex, mm-hmm. One of my teachers suggested that I look at the jewellery course at Middlesex University. And there I saw that people were working within jewellery, but in a very conceptual way, using really unusual materials. Mm-hmm. So I realised that you could be really experimental within the field of jewellery. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of my making was very small and miniature. So I thought I was making sculptures, but actually I was making like little handheld miniature objects. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. And so you did your foundation and then you went on to the Royal College of Art mm-hmm. to do your master's. Mm-hmm. So what's been the process since you graduated from there?
So as soon as I left the Royal College, I needed somewhere to work, really. And I did rent a workshop for a brief period, but then quickly set up a workshop with Karen Hartley. Mm-hmm. And it was like a room that was definitely more than me and Karen needed. So we started to sublet to other jewellers. Mm-hmm. And then we were commissioned to do some teaching as well. Mm-hmm. So we were teaching kids like in the park, like medal making. It was around the time of the Olympics. So uh-huh. we were making medals with kids. Mm-hmm. And teaching developed. So we've got an extra space where we started running classes and mm-hmm. teaching jewellery making. And it's just grown from there, really. Mm-hmm. So like a major part of my business or income is mm-hmm. teaching and running a workshop. Okay. I really, you know, lots of jewellers work in isolation, probably, or like in small groups. But I like a quite sociable atmosphere, working atmosphere. So that's what I've kind of built in Walthamstow.
Okay. And the other side then, so you've got the teaching and the business side where you're teaching classes. And then your making side, your actual own creations. How has that developed since leaving Royal College?
So it was at the Royal College that I made my first chain, mm-hmm. Which was Chain of Thought. And then since then, I've developed a jewellery collection around that sculptural piece. Mm-hmm. And then I started to develop other chain styles. So not only was I making chain, but I was exploring ideas about chain. Mm-hmm. The idea of if chain is to add strength and flexibility to a materials, mm-hmm. How to undermine that in different ways. With the rope chain, it was by constructing it from very fine and multiple wires. Mm-hmm. And then with hollow chain, it's like, it's quite a chunky chain, but it's mm-hmm. so fragile and sort of hollow inside. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that contradiction. I've continued to work with the themes about chain and materials mm-hmm. and just working in a different scale, really. I suppose, like, it was about 10 years ago now that I left the Royal College, mm-hmm. and I've kind of tried not to kind of compromise my ideas by being sort of commercial, really. Mm-hmm. Although I have made commercial projects, it's been really important to continue making sculptural works, which mm-hmm. is challenging, but it's really fulfilling, so...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's challenging on two counts because you need the time and then you're not working with a material that's generally cheap.
No, yeah, so, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's always been a commitment to the material, uh-huh. like investing back into silver and gold. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I love that hollow chain. I hope I did it justice in the intro. I just couldn't stop looking at it and I just loved the process and... Yeah, I just love the exposure on the surface. It's like it's been shorn, like, cleanly across. It's so incredibly beautiful. Mm.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It's interesting, actually, because originally I was going to make the chain hollow, but have the holes as very discreet, small, little drill holes. Mm-hmm. As me and Kasia started to dissolve the silver from the inside, we realised very quickly that we were going to need bigger holes. Mm-hmm. But it's also referencing filed curb, which is very manufactured-looking chain style. Mm-hmm. So I like that happened. It happened for a reason, but also it's kind of referencing the machine-made mm-hmm. again.
And did you have to make bigger holes because the silver wasn't able to come out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To increase the surface area for the acid to dissolve the silver.
Wow. And is that a technique that you discovered, or is that a technique you knew about, or because it's, I was so like, wow, I'd never even thought that was a process that would exist.
Yeah, so nitric acid is commonly used to clean gold because it removes, on the surface of the gold, it removes the copper and the silver, and it leaves a very thin layer of fine gold, and it makes it a beautiful colour.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also used to, in working with silver as well, but again, because it strips the copper.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using sterling silver, it strips the copper from the surface, so you get a really clean finish. But it's also used to make hollow chain.
Yeah.
Like traditionally, you would put copper inside and then you would dip it in nitric acid.
Mm-hmm.
So the use of silver in order to extract silver nitrate was what I was doing differently.
To work with Kasia so that she could then do the wet plate collodion.
Yeah. Yes.
So how did that collaboration come about? Because it's so fascinating and the image is gorgeous as well. And with the chain, because what's interesting in the images is that the chain is just there. It's not jumping out at you. And then you realize, like, it's like a soft focus. And suddenly you realize, oh, that's the chain.
Mm.
So how did that collaboration come about?
I met Kasia about 10 years ago and we're friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I know about her process because she's photographed my work before.
Mm-hmm.
She produced some beautiful images of Roper's patient.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing because she works a lot with the positive and the negative. And I don't completely understand her process, so I shouldn't explain it too much because I won't do it justice. But she produced these beautiful images where the rope was like this very dark, heavy thing, object.
Mm-hmm.
And it immediately I realized the connection with the silver
mm-hmm.
because it was this, it was silver that I was looking at
mm-hmm.
As a representation of this silver chain.
Yeah.
And I think we briefly mentioned it when she photographed Roper's patient, this idea of collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
And then the opportunity came up that we worked together and produced this piece for Collect,
mm-hmm.
Craft Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened in about 5 weeks.
Wow.
It was so quick,
wow.
from start to finish.
Yeah.
And it was another learning experience for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
We knew in theory that it could work,
mm-hmm.
but in practice, we had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Kasia knows some scientists and I know a couple of people as well. So we were phoning people like, this isn't happening right and what should we do and how long do we leave it in the acid and what temperature should it be and what concentration should it be? So a lot of the people we were talking about knew the theory of it but had never done the practical.
Yeah.
So they were also really excited. It was amazing because I felt like I couldn't sleep. It was so exciting.
Yeah.
The actual dissolving of the silver happened over 5 to 7 days, I think.
Oh, wow. I was so naive. I thought it just dissolved like that.
No, it was a really long process. I think because the acid had to get inside the links and eat all the silver away. But, it's also like the start of the process, the cooking, is quite volatile and loads of fumes come off. And mm-hmm. so we had to do it outside and be very careful, wearing protective clothing.
Yeah.
And it was quite theatrical.
Which I love because it's kind of, this is what I was thinking about when I've been looking at your work, is that like the alchemy is present. It's present in the finished piece and it retains the magic.
Mm.
So I'm wondering if you can talk about, you know, working with real materials that can change, that are malleable, that you can mix and melt down and make and form something else.
With these sort of more involved projects, which are more sort of ideas led, the thinking and planning for them happens such a long time in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So with Swap, the project I did with Kasia, we talked about it maybe 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and then it's finally happened. Even though the making of it happened quickly,
mm-hmm.
the thinking about it was over a period of years.
Mm-hmm.
Another piece I made, which was called Curb,
mm-hmm.
which was an iron link and a silver link.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was something that I'd been thinking about for years as well. Because not only do you have the material investment, it's the thinking and the technique as well that needs to be developed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always challenging those as well. So I'm challenging myself technically because it's what really interests me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can't happen quickly. It has to really take time. And I'll probably do experiments and work on things on a small scale before I work on a big scale, make samples and things. It's also difficult because I'm working with materials and experimenting with materials. I can't easily like practice in copper and hope that it's going to work in silver or gold because it doesn't really work like that. I need to make samples in the material that I'm going to work with.
Mm-hmm. And how do you manage that patience? Being a rather impatient person myself, I kind of want results relatively quickly. Is that just part of it? Is that part of your nature? Or is it like something you've learned?
It must be part of my nature. I mean, it's like one of the most common things people say to me is, yeah. Wow, you're so patient, or you must be so patient.
Mm-hmm.
I just really enjoy that very time-consuming, labour-intensive making process.
Mm-hmm. Which is linked to Rope is Patient, mm. because that must have taken forever to make.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like Rope is Patient, at the beginning, it was just, you know, like a few centimetres or a few inches, and yeah. it was growing very, very slowly.
Yeah.
And because I was adding to it over a period of years,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know when it would be finished. Mm-hmm. And lots of people saw it through its iteration, through its growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was one of those projects where it's like, wow, you're still doing that. Still working at that.
Great you finished it, because it's one of those things that I think long-term projects can just easily just get sidelined.
Mm.
And it's amazing because it is epic when you look at it. You know, I explained it like when I saw it over the model shoulder and then it just comes out and around the floor. I was like, that would have taken forever. Because I understand it's all handmade. Mm. Like you can understand that when you look at it, which is a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, I want the hand to always be very present in the work.
So can you explain like a typical working day for you, if there is a typical working day?
A perfect day or a typical day?
Tell me a perfect day, because everyone wants a perfect day.
So a perfect day might be sort of arriving in the workshop and like having a cup of tea. And my favourite kind of making is this kind of slow making. So I'll pick up the project that I'm working on and maybe there's like some kind of like puzzling thing which I've resolved and I'm just working on it and growing it and adding to it. The way that I work in my workshop is there are a lot of people around me and lots of people come to visit the workshop, and I've got meetings often throughout the day. So like my favourite time to work often is like late into the evening when there's less people around and there's less distractions, because it's very... Like, even though there are people around, it's very easy to kind of shut all that off and just focus on the small thing that you're doing and just get lost in it for hours. Because, unfortunately, my workshop has no windows, so it's easy for time to escape me.
Evaporate.
Yeah. And I'll realise, like, I'll suddenly be thinking, why am I so hungry? And I'll realise it's, like, 4 in the afternoon and it's past lunchtime and... Yeah.
So conducive in one way.
Yeah, exactly.
What is your creative process, and does it differ from commissions to pieces you instigate?
I'm an exhibition jeweller.
Mm-hmm.
So although I make collections that are for sale and I wholesale them to different retailers and stuff, and I do that kind of traditional format of jewellery making, I also make one-off pieces for exhibitions. So they're not kind of commissions necessarily, but I might know, for example, that I've got a show and I've got a certain amount of space and I can make whatever I want to for that show. So I'm really lucky to have that, really, because the other side of being a jeweler, like a production jeweler, means that you are making like 10 of one piece and making it over and over again. Which is also, like, I do enjoy that kind of making as well, the production work, because I love the repetition. And, yeah, so it's not that I don't enjoy that, but I also like to be challenging my processing and technique by making, like, new pieces and working with new materials and stuff.
You talked earlier on about not wanting to focus or go down the route of being fully commercial and actually stay true to the material you're working with and your kind of thought process around pushing the boundaries of what that is. How did you get to that point? How did you go, actually, I'm going to follow this path instead of maybe going down and working in jewellery production or having multiple collections and selling them?
If I was working that production route, I would consider myself like a more successful jeweler. So I have tried to do that and kind of failed. Well, not failed, but I feel like I'm less successful at doing that. Like if you do manage to do that, then it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you can make something by hand that is the right price and that you can sell it in the right places, and like it's genius if you can do that. But I haven't managed to do that to a stage where I can support myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found that when I try and push myself in that direction, it doesn't really work. And what I really enjoy to do is making one-off pieces,
mm-hmm.
which is less commercial, but it's kind of what excites me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the audience always sees that. They can see what has been pleasurable for you to make or not. So,
and so then how does the route of like exhibiting it at art fairs and jewellery fairs, how does that come about then? How does, because that's what you're saying, most of your bigger pieces and unique pieces are showcased in these places.
Mm.
So how do you establish that?
I suppose you need to have good relationships with galleries.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if you know the fairs that you want to show in, then you have to have relationships with the right galleries and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And to show yourself to be a kind of reliable maker.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, with Collect, for example, I was showing with Bishopsland Educational Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a residency that focuses on traditional techniques. And they showcase a lot of, like, silversmiths. So I've been lucky enough to show with them 4 years in a row at mm-hmm. Collect. And I guess over that time, I've proved myself to kind of make interesting work that they invite me back again. Mm-hmm. Other than that, like Goldsmiths Fair is a big opportunity as well. Mm-hmm. And that's something you have to apply for.
So there's a lot of kind of social interaction, developing relationships so that you can find the niches that where your work can sit.
Yeah.
Which I guess is quite a journey as well. It's quite a risk, like you're saying, you know, the production side of things and selling things, while you might not feel that's quite right for you, I don't see it as being unsuccessful because the work you're making is really unique as well.
Yeah, I think it's a lot to undertake because mm-hmm. if you're doing big shows like that, it's a risk because you're investing so much time in the production of the piece and the mm-hmm. materials, mm-hmm. and then the show itself might be expensive,
mm-hmm.
and you just hope that someone's going to come and enjoy your work and purchase it.
Mm-hmm.
But it has worked up until now, so
yeah. Are you doing something right?
Yeah.
Okay, and also, like, you've done quite a few collaborative projects. How do these come about and what do they give your practice?
So my longest creative working relationship is with Romilly Somare Smith. So I met Romilly about 10 years ago, actually. I was working at a gallery and one of Romilly's friends used to come into the gallery and she knew I was a jeweller, and she just mentioned that she had a friend that she'd like me to meet.
Mm.
So it was all a bit cryptic and I didn't know really what the meeting was about, but I went to Romilly's house and met Romilly there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first saw her pieces, I realised I did recognise her work. It's really original, her aesthetic. It's kind of mysterious and dark, and her pieces are like miniature landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
So on the surface of a metal, she'll put lots of tiny little multiple pieces which give an overall texture of like undergrowth or like organic moss or kind of lichen or something.
Which sounds beautiful. So how does that collaboration work?
My role is a translator,
mm-hmm.
because so Romilly is no longer able to make her work anymore, mm-hmm. because she has multiple sclerosis,
mm-hmm.
and so she describes her ideas verbally,
mm-hmm.
and I interpret her words into jewellery, and I work in her house,
mm-hmm.
because part of the way that we work together is that she needs like continual involvement through the process of making one piece.
Mm-hmm.
So often throughout the working day, I'll be working in the workshop upstairs and then I'll take a piece down to show her and just check that like it's developing in the right way. And over time, like initially when I first started working with her, it was about a year of nearly full-time working.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, we really developed a language, a way of talking about the pieces. We developed techniques or textures, which we gave particular names. And yeah, and I think that investment at the beginning has meant that now when we work, it's much more free and fluid and easy to do, like to interpret her words. Because, I mean, not only is it really difficult to describe an abstract form,
mm.
but then to interpret that and try and get it right as well. It's almost like a paradox, because it's seemingly not possible, but we make it work somehow. I think it's because of the relationship, really, that we have.
It's amazing, and yeah, it must be incredible in terms of going backwards and forwards as well, because it's her creative mind and it's your creative hands that are making it, but obviously you've got the skill and technique as well, and yeah, sounds amazing.
So it's not just me now who works for Romilly, there's also Anna Wales and Laura Andrew, and I find that really interesting as well, because we're different people and different makers. So what's her relationship like with Anna and Laura compared to mine? And like the pieces that she might ask me to make will be different from the ones that Anna and Laura make. And it's just interesting as well, like with Romilly's work now, each piece goes through language first before being realised. And I think that's really interesting, because like often with my work, it's all thought and then making, and then language comes like at the end. Like I'm having to describe things after finishing them.
And interesting for you to have both, isn't it? Like to be able to see how they differ and how the work, what you're contributing to, yeah. Great. You also run Made by Ore, so can you tell me a little bit about that?
So Made by Ore is a jewellery workshop and a teaching space. So there's now 8 sort of jewellers who work there on a permanent basis. I also run the teaching space. So we run like Silver Saturdays, which are just general come and make some jewellery days. Yeah. But we also do like masterclasses, which are based on technique. So we do wax carving, but I don't teach that. And I teach chain making. We also do sand casting and like soldering as well. So it's good. I've really enjoyed the teaching. It's like become a part of like the craft process, really, because like there's so much learning that happens for me in my process, but through teaching I'm forced to articulate it, and that kind of does something with the knowledge. I don't know, so you have like this knowledge in your hands and then you're forced to verbalize it in order to teach it, and that kind of cements the knowledge somehow. I don't really know how it works, but it's necessary, I'd say, to the making.
What skills do you need to be a jeweler?
I would say that you need to love working with materials, and you need to be very determined, because it's like hard work. It's hard work because, I mean, it's the same with all visual arts, I'd say, that like you have to deal with people's feedback as well, and it might not always be positive, and you need to be able to take that and absorb it and move on and learn from it. And I'm someone that really enjoys like criticism as well, like if like sometimes
you're like, patient, you enjoy criticism.
Well, I remember this woman was looking at my work, and she like, because I don't clean up solder seams, I leave them in the piece, and she's like, it's not finished. I was like, oh, she thinks it's unfinished. But you know, you've got to just laugh at stuff like that, because yeah, it makes you realise that there are different ways of thinking.
And seeing, I guess, as well. Yeah. So what's been one of the biggest challenges in your career? Nothing, I imagine, because you're so patient. You love criticism.
I think the biggest challenge, or like the thing that freaks me out the most, is like the security of space. Like the dream is to have this beautiful workshop with windows and like ventilation and all the normal things, heating, hot water. But in London, it's not really realistic. And you do have to deal with the fact that you might just need to move every few years. And it's hard work because, like, everything's incredibly heavy. And and security as well. I always worry about that.
And that is really difficult.
Yeah, and there are amazing spaces like Cockpit Arts, which offer workshops for jewellers. Because a lot of people won't have jewellers, partly because of the security issue, but also it's like dirty and noisy. And yeah, so there's lots of reasons. But there are amazing spaces. Like Cockpit's in the middle of London, it's in Holborn, so it's like great to have that space in the middle of London. But I think the way that I work is with the teaching as well. It means that I need quite a lot of space. It kind of feeds itself as well, which is great. It means that I can be more independent, I think.
Which is great, because you do also need that revenue stream to allow you to have a bit more freedom on your creative side. It makes total sense to have done that. Like, it's, yeah, such a great idea. Mm. I love that it's so popular.
Mm. Yeah, that's really good. I think there's a real hunger for, like, people to be making things.
Mm.
And lots of people that come to do a workshop, do a one-day workshop, are just amazed at what they can produce in a day. Mm. And, yeah, and, like, the last kind of real analog thing left in most people's lives is, like, cooking, really.
Mm.
And the craze for, like, cooking and, like, producing things, mm-hmm. like baking and stuff, yeah. is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that crafts is having a real kind of revival, because mm-hmm. people are realising that they can do things, and that with the appetite, then there's more and more classes, and, yeah, it's really good. I think it's exciting.
What do you love about being a jeweller?
I love just, like, my time is my own, mm-hmm. and I don't have to answer to anybody.
Mm.
I know I'm so lucky to have that, because lots of people don't. I'm also, like, the way that I've made my life is it's very, like, convenient. I live very close to my workshop and, like, just cycle to work every day. So, like, I love that part of the way that I'm a jeweler.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, yeah, love working with materials. Love learning as well.
So how do you fuel your creativity? Where do you go? What do you see? What do you do?
I do like going to exhibitions, and I love meeting other makers and talking to them and, like, sharing ideas. Mm-hmm. And I need to do more of that, really.
You are quite busy.
Yeah. But my mum always says, like, you need to feed your soul. Go and see some shows. And mm-hmm. I think the materials really inspire me, though. And I love sort of going to museums like the Pitt Rivers and... Mm.
Oh my God, the Pitt Rivers is amazing.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give to someone considering pursuing a career as a jeweler?
I think you really need to, like, start with one really simple idea. Make sure that the, like, making and a production is, like, really efficient. And because there's a lot of people who want to start businesses and they're, you know, starting with, like, zero, really. Mm-hmm. So, like, trying to get the skills and then starting the business is, like, two separate things. Mm. So it's almost like you need to make sure that the making is, like, perfected, and then once that's done, you've got a small collection, then you're ready to, like, market it and send it out into the world. So, yeah, as long as you can dedicate the time to, like, working out your collection, I think that's the most important thing, really.
Okay. So what have you got coming up in the next few weeks and months?
Well, I have got one show
mm-hmm.
at the White Conduit Project in May, and that's curated by Caroline Broadhead. Well, she's invited me to show,
mm-hmm.
and it's called The Size of Thoughts. So I'll be showing a piece in collaboration with Kasia.
Mm-hmm.
It will be a new piece. It will probably be, because I haven't made it yet, it will be like a graduated silver curb chain,
mm-hmm.
which is half dipped in acid
mm-hmm.
and half untouched.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cash is going to produce, with the silver nitrate, mm-hmm. she'll produce an image which is half positive, half negative of the chain. Yeah,
I love how this collaboration is developing further.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to do. Yeah. Like, there's so many variables. There's so many things to play with. Like, mm-hmm. time and weight, and like the weight of the image and the weight of the chain, and then the intense, yeah, and it's very exciting,
mm-hmm.
and we want to do lots more,
mm-hmm.
but then I'm also I've been working on the Jerwood project. I'm aiming to have that finished by the end of May. The show is in June, and my proposal is to make chain
mm-hmm.
groups of links from three materials, wood, iron and silver.
Mm-hmm.
Each link plays a role in the making of the next link. So the wood is the starting material,
mm-hmm.
and I'm carving link shapes, and then I'm using the wood as a master to cast into iron, and then the iron is a former around which I'm going to hammer silver, and they'll be linked together.
Oh my God, that sounds beautiful.
Yeah. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's incredible. Oh, I can't wait to see that. So coming to the end of the interview, I've so loved chatting to you. I definitely want some of your jewellery. I'm wondering if I can ask you something I ask everyone. Is there a career or job in the creative industries you know little about? And then I could potentially get someone in that role on, and also someone that you would recommend or suggest to come on the podcast.
Yeah, so people that you might want to think about interviewing. Kasia was next. Her process is amazing, and her story of how she's learned the collodion process as well is really interesting. And how she's managed to make that into her career, I think, is really interesting, mm-hmm. because I think she studied fashion photography.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's not typical.
Yeah.
And also other makers that might be interesting are Kathleen O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
She writes poetry and then responds to the poetry with objects. And Jasleen Kerr is really interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a lot to say with her work, and I'm sure she'd have a lot to say in an interview as well.
So. Okay, awesome. They sound great. Thank you so much for your time today, Lucy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haverson. And to our editors, Daniel Clark and Laura Francis. And to Maria Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.